You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
On this week's Lyric Feature, we are just late for a bicentennial as Chris Nicol travels from Canada to Cork to trace the story and track the legacy of a largely unknown 1825 Irish migration to Ontario. This is The Forgotten Migration.
All right, here we go. We are going to have a fun night of trivia, whether we like it or not. I am your host, Clara Leahy. Is everybody ready for our first round? Woo! Here we go. All right.
It's July 2025, and I'm in an ice hockey arena in the village of Douro in Ontario, Canada.
You are in teams that care for each other.
I'm at a sort of pub quiz commemorating Irish immigrants, often called the Peter Robinson settlers, who came to Douro in 1825.
This section is specific history about the Peter Robinson settlement.
For the last few years, communities have been planning a 200-year anniversary.
Okay, that's why we're here today.
Tonight, the arena is packed.
So, our specific Peter Robinson settlement questions. Number one, what Irish county did the majority of the 1825 settlers to Douro come from?
Named after its organizer, the Peter Robinson settlers were part of a British government-assisted migration scheme to what was then the British colony of Upper Canada.
I am looking for a county in Ireland.
50,000 people applied to go, which gives you a sense of the poverty in Ireland at the time.
Okay, number five, how many people left Ireland with the 1825 Robinson immigration?
For Catholics, who made up most of the applicants, colonial rule in Ireland offered a bleak future.
I'm looking for a number.
The ones chosen had their passage paid and were given land near what is today the city of Peterborough, northeast of Toronto.
Number 10, what was the name of the settlement before it was called Peterborough? And I will accept either the English name or the Indigenous name.
This, of course, is a colonial story on both sides of the ocean.
Ooh, let's hear this one. How much land was each settler initially allocated? So when they first arrived, how much land did they get?
Upper Canada was home to First Nations people, including where the Irish settlers got their initial 70 acres of free land.
How much land did they first get when they arrived?
It makes this a complicated story.
Our next question. How many ships were in the 1825 Robinson immigration?
I'm interested in this because I'm a Canadian but have lived in Ireland for over 20 years.
I'm looking for a number.
I sort of have a foot in both countries.
All right, take a look around. Take a look around. Name any of the three surnames, the last names of Robinson immigrants.
As you'll find out in this story, many families still live where their ancestors settled, which has created a rich seam of Irish culture, tradition, and music.
Take a look around. And you know what? Yes, spelling counts for this one. Don't mess it up.
This packed arena is filled with descendants.
Okay, so we're waiting for our papers to be collected.
It makes this event all the more special.
Referees, are those all the answer sheets?
And makes the results of the pub quiz a little predictable.
I know you all already know these answers, right? This isn't new information to anyone. Okay. What Irish county did the majority of the 1825 settlers come from? Cork. Excellent. How many people left Ireland? 2024. Excellent. 2,024 people left. Okay. Name of the settlement before it was called Peterborough. Scott's Plain, or the place at the end of the rapids. How many ships? There, nine ships. The nine ships and the half-wits. Okay.
This Irish migration is foundational for the community of Douro and others around Peterborough.
I'll list them off. Albion, Star, Regulus, Fortitude, John Barry, Resolution.
But until recently, it is a forgotten story back in Ireland.
Wonderful. Thank you, Frank, for playing us in.
It's May 2025. On the promenade in Cove in County Cork, a small group are marking the departure of the nine ships to Canada.
I would like to welcome everyone to this very special ceremony. This marks and commemorates the 200th anniversary of the Peter Robinson Settlers Emigration Scheme.
That is Amanda Slattery, and she's incredibly 21st. Important to this story.
We stand together to remember the hundreds of families who left Ballyharra region and the counties abounding for Upper Canada.
Amanda discovered the Peter Robinson Settlers through her work with the Ballyhora Development Company.
Cove, as it was then known, just beyond where...
A trained archaeologist, she felt compelled to find out more.
So for over a decade, we have researched and we've reconnected this emigration from the point of origin to the point of settlement.
Like, I was driven by curiosity. I really was. Why do I not know about this? What happened to them? Right? Those were the two things.
She then began digging for evidence of the 1825 migration.
In the rediscovery of this emigration history, just due to the sheer volume of families that departed from our region of North Cork and East Limerick.
Each community had descendants in Canada. So Amanda began tracing where they came from, name by name.
Families from Mitchestown, 22 families from Donnerail, 22 families.
I don't know. It's like a filing cabinet in my head. Like, I can go Heidi O'Sullivan, Houlihan's, Charleville. I can go Patricia Young, Young's, Newport. I can go through everybody and know their connection and where. And it's actually logged in a structure in my brain at this point. So their names connect to somebody, connect to somebody.
Amanda then began compiling a spreadsheet of every person who left on the nine ships, the descendants who've reached out to her, and potential matches back in Ireland.
I suppose I'm the consistent piece in this, like I'm the chink in the chain here that's keeping the two chains together, right? Pull it all together, that's my art. And as everyone calls my matchmaking skills, or my historic dating service, as I like to refer to it.
Everybody knows Amanda. She's dug up a forgotten migration. And now, with her team in Mitchelstown, is building back a memory of it in Ireland.
To close, I want to read a poem to all of you. It was written in 1925 by P.G. Townes. And P.G. was the grandson of Joanna Sullivan, later Townes. She was the great-grandson of Darby and Alice Sullivan, and they left on the Regulus in 1825 from Bregown in Mitchelstown. And Nancy Townes shared this poem with me. It's called Old Boys and Girls Come Home. In the month of May, on a sunny day from the lovely Cove of Cork, with vessels nine upon the brine, 2,000 souls embark. They leave their homes and friends alone on Erin's shore so free, for a lonely strand in a foreign land, in Canada or the sea. In the morning light, the sun rose bright, all traces of the land concealed.
All traces of land concealed.
No ships or barks from the Cove of Cork.
No ships or bark from the Cove of Cork across the sea revealed. Old girls, you hear, old boys, give ear. Come home, don't you ever say no. But meet on the sod where your forefathers trod 100 years ago.
That's Nancy Townes. I'm meeting with her and her dad, Mike, over coffee in Douro, Ontario. Mike's grandfather wrote that poem.
My grandfather, P.G. Townes, he was the president of the Old Boys and Old Girls Reunion in 1925. Which was the 100-year celebration of the Peter Robinson immigrants. And his grandmother came from, Joanna Sullivan came from Ireland in 1825. She came on the Regulus.
P.G. Townes opened his general store in 1892. In the 1970s, Mike and his wife Rosemary took it over. Then began publishing books about the store and the community at large. A task that would literally save its history.
The store burned down 8 years ago, but I was working on those books, and I brought all the old papers from the attic over here to, you know, to use them, and you'll see a lot of documents in there that with my grandfather's handwriting or my dad's handwriting, and so that stuff was all saved.
This is where music enters this story, through Mike's mother, Mary Towns, Nancy's grandmother.
This over here are grandma's songs. Do you see them, Dad? There's Johnny Doyle.
Oh, yeah.
This is Skibbereen.
Nancy studied anthropology, which gave her a new way of looking at the family archive collection, especially papers from her grandmother, Mary, who ran the post office in the town's general store.
We've got all of these song sheets that Grandma wrote out on old envelopes from the post office of the songs she knew. Like when she didn't have a customer, she would lilt away behind the glass singing her songs. And I mean, she would sing all the time.
A lot of them would be older songs. Yeah, well, most of them would be the older songs that her dad worked in the lumber camps, and that was the entertainment after dark. In the evenings they would tell stories and sing songs.
Ontario held vast forests where lumber crews worked during the winter. When the men came home, they'd bring back songs, which is how Mary Towns learned them.
Her mother died when she was four, so her dad and her would go to visit neighbors, and they would be other Irish families that came out. They would sing songs to pass the time on the way to wherever they were going. And when they got there, if the song wasn't finished, they wouldn't get out of the buggy until the song was finished, yeah.
And the Sunday suppers, you've told us about Sundays, yeah, when the store would be closed. And
yeah, and my uncle, John, Clary, and Grace, they would come out. And he, even though he was a really good fiddle player, he didn't own a fiddle. And he would use my mom's.
Some of those Towns family music sessions were recorded on cassette tapes in the 1980s. As you can hear, it was a full living room.
My mom would chord on the piano, and my dad would chord. We had a long piano bench, so if he was on the piano, she'd come along and push him up to the treble. And she always wanted the bass. She wanted control there. I think that's the piano bench right there, and the piano.
Music was always part of the town's family home, but an encounter in October 1956 made it even more important. That afternoon, a strange visitor pulled up to the town's general store.
I remember she came along in a Volvo car, and when I was a kid, you didn't see too many Volvos. You automatically think, well, this lady's not in the grocery business, I guess you'd say.
The woman's name was Edith Folk. She was a folklorist looking to record old songs.
I don't think I'd ever seen a tape recorder before, and this was quite a big, heavy machine. I remember her setting it up in the living room, and we were just around the corner, my brother and I, sitting in the stairwell and just listening to everything that was going on. And the neighbor kid was there, Joe Keating. And so all of a sudden, Joe Keating, during the middle of a recording, he yelled out, "There's a mouse!" And anyway, she suggested maybe the children could go to another room. Yeah.
With the children out of the way, Edith Folk recorded around a dozen songs that first day and would record more in the coming years, including Mike's grandfather, Michael Clary.
Michael Clary, I'm named after him. And he was like me, he had, his right arm was longer than his left. And he kind of had my eyes droop a bit and his droop a bit. In the old pictures, I see that.
Michael Clary was the one who'd worked in the lumber camps.
If you wanted to hear a song, I have it set ready to go there of my grandpa starting to sing this song called The Corked Leg. It's a kind of a comical, light-hearted song. Did you want to hear it right now or
Mike
come back?
Takes me to his office, which seems like the Duro Community Archive, with shelves of books and folders containing scraps of paper dating back over a century. There's also a reel-to-reel player set up.
This is the machine here. Dad actually bought a reel recorder after Edith started coming. I think he was so taken by the recorder that she brought. And it's in the basement, and we're having some technical difficulties with it. So this is another one. Here, we'll let you have a seat here, and Dad can run the machine.
This, I'm sure, was recorded by Edith Folk, and it says December 3rd, 1958. And she gave my mom this tape. And, of course, we keep everything, eh?
And, Dad, you said that's Edith's writing, right?
I'm just presuming that would be, because I never saw a red pen until I was in my 40s. Okay. So this is the corked leg, it's called.
238.
You're at 245 and it's at 238. Okay. Yeah, 234 now. Yeah, that's good.
You ready? Pull the bell.
That's my grandfather.
Okay. I'll tell you a tale without any phlegm and Holland do well, my ear on clam. Who every morning said I am the richest merchant on Rotterdam, right to Rulululululululululululululay. One day he was stuffed as full as an egg, a poor relation came to beg.
Edith Folk worked the machine herself, often in the singer's living room. They were not performances, but raw folk recordings.
He ran over a hill. He ran over hill and dale and plain to rest his weary bones, he feigned.
The Corked Leg was first published in London in 1832, a long way from Ontario's lumber camps.
My story I've told both plain and free of the richest merchant that could be, who never was buried so dead, you see, and I've been singing his L.E.G.
I'm on the hunt for more information about these songs. Fortunately, a group called the Nine Ships have been holding history events throughout the first week of August.
One of the challenges of immigration that we've been exploring throughout these last few days is how much of your original culture can you retain? How much do you have to adapt?
I'm sitting in the Knights of Columbus Hall in Peterborough at an event bringing together authors who have written about the Peter Robinson settlers.
Now I'll call on our next speaker.
I'm here to see Alan Kirby, who literally wrote the book on Edith Folk.
I am a historian, but I study probably the most obscure elements of history. I study the history of music. When the people came through the Robinson immigration, they brought with them a music culture. The music from this Peterborough region is known internationally as one of the hotbeds of folk music in the world, equal to the Mississippi Delta, equal to Appalachia, probably exceeding Newfoundland. But music cultures are beneath the surface. And from 1825 to approximately 1950, the music culture of the Irish settlers remained silent. Nobody knew it was there. Somebody had to unlock that music culture. And there was a lady from Saskatchewan who had an interest in folk music and folk stories. Her name was Edith Folk. That's all I've got. Read the book.
When I talk to Alan afterwards, he tells me how he discovered Edith Folk.
It just came by chance. When I looked at a newspaper article about Edith Folk, it mentions Towns General Store. And Towns General Store is just down the road from where I live. So I thought, oh, this is interesting. I'll go down and talk to Michael Towns, who was a proprietor at the time. And he says, oh, yes, Edith Folk came here to record, recorded my mother.
A stranger comes to meet me at the door.
Mike Towns told him the story of Edith Folk, and Alan got even more interested. He started a PhD, immersing himself in Edith Folk's archive. It revealed the scale of the discovery at Towns General Store.
And that old familiar place, I can see a
when Edith went home, she started listening to the lyrics of these songs and said, some of these songs are child ballads from Europe. And a child ballad is simply a ballad that was cataloged by Dr. Childs at Harvard University in the 1880s. And she said, I can't believe that this lady is singing these songs. Where? How did they get here? Edith got very excited about this and went back. And Mary Towns said, oh, there's all kinds of people that sing these old songs. And that's how she got going from home to home to home.
As Farmer John from his work came home on a summer's afternoon.
In a two-year period, she recorded about 2,000 songs.
To sing himself a tune. For this was the tune, right, fal-lal-dido sang in the maple grove. Right, fall down, fall do right day was the tune that the old cow died on.
Edith's discovery turned music scholarship at the time on its head. It challenged a long-held idea that folk music in Canada was only found in the East Coast and Quebec.
Musicologists said Ontario's dead. There's no folk songs in Ontario. Quebec is so rich, the Maritimes are so rich, Ontario's got nothing.
The oldest cow in the farmer's flock tried hard to sing that song, but she could not reach.
The songs and the stories are important, but it gives us a lens into what our culture was like.
Right, full on, full
there were parties and sing songs, but that was within their community.
The farmer laughed till tears ran down his cheeks like cherries red.
At the time she discovered these songs, Edith Folk had a radio show on the CBC, Canada's national public broadcaster.
She used to go to Greenwich Village to buy her recordings for her radio show. She would take the train to New York, and she met Kenneth Goldstein in this record store. And of course, he was connected to the Lomaxes, who had recorded Lead Belly and Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie. And he said, look, I can get a record produced if you can give me some raw recordings. And that's how Songs of Ontario was produced through Smithsonian Folkways.
The album Folk Songs of Ontario came out in 1958. It includes 20 songs that Edith recorded, mostly from around Peterborough.
Maybe Mom and Dad played that record when I was a kid, but I don't remember listening to it.
When Nancy Towns did listen to Folk Songs of Ontario, it was a night she'll never forget.
I remember sitting in my house one winter evening in the dark, other than, like, I'm not trying to make up a pretty picture here, but I do have a wood stove that I heat with through the winter. So the light of the wood stove, and I found that album and I pressed play.
A fair maid walked in her father's garden.
And it just floored me, like hearing Grandma's voice in the late 1950s.
He stepped up to her and kindly viewed her.
I had grown up singing with Grandma. Grandma was one of my musical mentors, along with Dad. She made sure that myself and my cousin Jane were taking singing lessons, and we joined the Irish festival choir with her.
You seem to be.
And she also instilled the joy of singing in me. That's such an immense gift that she gave me.
It's look over yonder at that fine castle.
The anthropologist side of Nancy was captivated by the song as an artifact from the past. But as a singer, it was far more personal.
I'd started listening to it, and I just started harmonizing with her.
Oh, what care I for your fine castles? Or what care I for the stormy sea?
There I was. Once again, I was singing with her in my living room in front of the fire, and it was with her recording.
If my dear Willie sails home to me.
In the next day or two, I brought the recordings to Mom and Dad's house and did the same thing. I played it and sang it for Mom and Dad, and I remember Dad had tears coming down his face.
Stand up, my pretty fair maid. Stand up.
Nancy then started performing this song with her niece, Jillian. So this recording spans four generations.
Gold and silver, and the stormy ocean to cross no more.
Oh, so you put up panels all the way along, did you?
Yeah, so for every building that was here or is here...
It's August 2025. In Douro, local farmer Patrick Leahy is giving Amanda Slattery and her family, who have all traveled over from Cork, a tour of the village.
That was the Townsend's. Their store was here and it burned.
So that was Nancy's family's?
Yeah.
In addition to running his farm, Patrick is also a local historian and helped plan Douro's commemoration.
And there's the best fiddler in the country going by, Donnell Leahy.
They're all related to you, Patrick,
No, they're different. They're Mitchellstown ones, and we're Ballyhooly, but out of Waterford.
Okay. Now, so there was no connection between the Mitchellstown Leahys and your Leahys?
No, they both came on the Fortitude.
Yeah.
And they both settled next door to each other.
Yeah.
But there was no known relation.
Okay.
But then they both married Mohurst. So we're all...
You're connected somewhere.
Somewhere along the way.
The Leahy blood, no.
So the Mitchellstown Leahys are the musical Leahys,
yes.
Are they?
Okay. Yeah. We're the less talented ones.
Oh, no.
Can't say that.
Following Patrick and Amanda around is like listening to long-lost relatives talk about long-lost relatives, especially when they enter the Douro Cemetery.
As you go through, there'll be ones with little green shamrocks on them, and they were the people that came in 1825 that are buried here.
The names on the headstones seem to trigger Amanda's archaeologist instincts.
What's the name on that one? Fahey's and Conway's. Egan, Sheehan's again. They're all here. Like, there's a huge amount, yeah.
Amanda's work back in Mitchellstown has meant she's already traced many of the families in this cemetery, with Patrick's help.
Kind of crunched the numbers on it. 70% of them or so were within that 10-kilometer radius of Mitchellstown. So we have a Fermoyes stone there, Marshallstown over there.
And Patrick, is there a lot of headstones where you'd get to the specific, like Marshallstown?
10%, maybe of the old section, maybe a little under. There'd be Glanworth, and there'd be Fermoy, there'd be Mitchellstown, and they're scattered throughout. Now, where else is more place name ones? Limerick here. There's a Galbally stone down that way. So there's native of Galbally, County Limerick.
Oh, that's the Allen's one.
And here they spell Allen on three stones. They spell it A-N, I-N, and E-N. The same people.
There must be some connection between the O'Briens of Mitchellstown and the Allens of Galbally. There was another woman had come to us and she had that in her family line.
Yes. Those O'Briens, there's so many of them.
There still is, to be honest.
So there's Mitchellstown.
Branches upon branches.
There's Michael O'Brien.
Native of Mitchellstown. They're the Tavern O'Briens. Yeah.
Patrick grew up hearing stories about the 1825 migration. But a few years ago, he decided he wanted to know more. So he pursued a master's degree focusing on his family's collection of letters and diaries.
We're up to our Leahy section. So this is my namesake, native of Waterford, but lived at Convemore near Ballyhooly.
It's a story that shows just how disruptive migration could be.
He's a widower. He brings his 12-year-old twins with him, but he leaves two kids at home. His wife had just died, and they're too young to come, so Mary stays and Bartholomew stays. 2 years later, he sends for them to come. They get separated. Mary gets here. Bartholomew gets on a ship at Quebec City and takes him to New York City instead of up to Ontario. Mm. They never see him again. They keep in letter writing contact. Her husband's buried down there. 20 years later, she dies. And unlike anyone else in the whole place, she's buried facing west, facing her father.
Oh, that's lovely, yeah.
Hard on the husband, maybe, but... But up in a kind of a family section, too. Yeah. And then the next one beside it was my great-great-grandfather from the second marriage who's built the house where we are.
A few days later, I make a visit to Patrick's farm, to the house his great-great-grandfather built. I found an Edith Folk recording of a song by a Michael Leahy, Patrick's great-grandfather.
Do we have the year there, Chris, on this one?
Patrick's family have lived on this farm in Duro, close to the Indian River, since the 1850s.
This is the reel.
Yeah.
And that's Indian River, November 1957.
Yeah.
Is when she was here.
Patrick's uncle Brian has also joined us. He grew up on the farm in the 1950s. He remembers when Edith came.
I'd be 9 years old.
You'd be 9 years old.
Yeah. I think they went into that other room in there. Because there was a few kids here at the time, eh? Small ones. They went in there to do the recording or whatever. As far as I can remember now.
And did you ever hear him sing at all other than this?
Yeah, he used to sing a bit here on the couch.
Okay.
Just now and again, he's singing a little bit of something.
Yeah.
But I can't tell you just what the songs were now. But...
So this one is called Maggie Howie. Have you heard of this song before?
I looked it up. So it's a murder ballad. It took place in Napanee, and it was quite a big deal in the papers and the news. And as a song, it really fits in an old tradition of a turned-away lover who maybe murders the person who rejected him, right? So that's a very old traditional narrative of the songs. And those wild, murderous types of stories, they often made their ways into a ballad, right, at the time.
Let's play it.
I found Michael Leahy's version of Maggie Howie in the Canadian Museum of History Archives in Ottawa. It's quite faint, but you can hear the first line is, I am an Irishman by birth. My name is Michael Lee.
Oh, I am an Irishman by birth. My name is Michael Lee. I courted a pretty fair maiden, oh, which was my destiny.
Yeah, because he's 91 at the time he's singing this.
He's 91.
At that time, he died in 93.
Yeah, age of 93 in 1959, he died.
Okay, so he died 2 years after this.
Yeah, but he's one of the oldest she went in. So maybe just for context, he's a grandson of the first Patrick Leahy who came in 1825. And his uncle, his father's older brother, was born in 1812 or so, 1811, and came in 1825. So he would have known his uncle, who came, he would have known a number of people who came as children with the Robinson group. So he's not far from it.
Both night and day it passed away in my love's company, till her parents interfere, she would not marry me.
So here we are, hearing that voice, who knew those people who came in 1825. And the people he knew, they knew people who were born in the 1750s. So that takes you back a long, long way in a hurry right here.
And being on a Sunday evening, my love alone did stray, where I soon followed after, and thus to her I did say, my dearest dear, I must be severe.
And so when a big tragedy would happen, it, through this time, it would often become a ballad. And they'd be set to the tunes of songs you knew. So this one, in her notes there, she says is often sung to the tune of The Wild Colonial Boy, which is an Irish song about somebody being sent to Australia. And so they take a local story and set it to an older tune that people would generally know. So that one goes, there was a wild colonial boy, Jack Duggan was his name.
She wrung her hands in anguish, she wept most bitterly.
So he's not quite at that speed, he's singing a bit slower, but he's also 91.
Was I being deep to all her cries, no mercy.
These songs were shared in the lumber camps where you go as young men to work when the farm work was done for the year, and they'd share them, and you get songs from different districts that way. And so we have a picture of him in one of these camps, because they'd often do a group picture. And it's, what, 1890? It's around then. It's quite current to when this song, when the tragedy happened.
Straight away to the woods, I didn't know my sorrow to bewail.
You hear the door closing, and it's that door. Yeah, there's a bit of a, just like we would, right? If now they were recording in that room, so they probably brought the kids in this room and closed the door. Which we've done that, it's like, get them out of here, close that door. So the same door. So that, to me, that's quite moving to hear that, here.
As she lay in a rosewood coffin, oh, those hundreds came to view.
It's a living recording that way, right? It would have seemed like a bad mistake at the time, but it's a neat, it's context, I guess.
If you listen close to the recording, you can also hear children in the background.
When I was soon overtaken and lodged in the county jail,
one of them could have been 9-year-old Brian.
Now, so sometimes he'd be sitting at the couch here. You know, he'd maybe just kind of sing a bit by himself, like just something to do, you know. I just never heard that much song from him at once.
Arrival await my trial, the judge will sentence me.
Edith Folk mentions another version of this song, one that contains a verse revealing that Maggie Howie's parents wouldn't let her marry Michael Lee.
I will strain on the gallows pipe.
Because Maggie was Protestant and Michael was Catholic.
So the Orange Order was at its kind of peak in Ontario power and politics as well as at the time.
What Patrick's talking about may surprise you, but when Canada became a country in 1867, its first prime minister was an Orangeman, and one-third of Protestant men were either in or had been in the Orange Order.
So locally here, Dummer Township, just to the immediate east of us, was very much a Protestant township, settled a few years after Durrow Township. The village of Warsaw had an Anglican church, a Methodist, Presbyterian, and then there were small Anglican churches and United churches seated throughout the township with local small congregations.
Not surprisingly, there were occasional flare-ups.
A large group would march on the 12th of July from Warsaw to the Orangemen's parades in Peterborough. They had to march through Durrow to get there. On the 12th of July, everyone along the roadway who had pumps that people used publicly to water their horses, well, they took the pump handles off. And so they couldn't water their horses on the way into town. At the same time, though, there was St. Patrick's Day parades in the 1860s in Peterborough, that men from Durrow, from Ennismore, Catholics from Otonabee, came into these parades and they were blocked by the Orange Order. And the kind of fracas broke out and the Orangemen had a cannon mounted on a sleigh. It was deep snow. And it was kind of a gunpoint face-off, and nobody started shooting, but there were knives and there were clubs. And the sheriff of Peterborough had to read the Riot Act and disperse everyone at the time.
On the album Folk Songs of Ontario, there's a track called The 12th of July, about a skirmish between Catholics and Protestants in Montreal.
Come all you gallant Irishmen who love your church and creed, I hope you'll pay attention to the few lines
like
that
many
you
of the
read.
Songs Edith Folk recorded, it would have been sung and passed along through the lumber camps.
It was on the 12th of last July the Orangemen did draw nigh, and to insult the Catholics they waved their colors high. To insult the Catholics, it was their one design. And they played the tunes King Billy played on the day he crossed the Boyne.
When my grandpa was dying in the hospital, in the mid-80s, he was sharing a room with two men in the room. And he, in the other bed, kind of had heard his name and, oh, here I am in the hospital with a Fenian, was his take on it. And he was an Orangeman, so they were both in there sharing the same hospital room. They would have been born maybe in the 1910s, and so it was an interesting kind of a finality there. We're all the same in the end.
Animosities would dull in the 20th century, but when the Peter Robinson settlers arrived in Ontario, the historic conflict was still close in their memory.
So come all you true-bred Catholics who love your church and creed, I hope you'll pay attention to what King Billy and Cromwell did. They tore down Catholic churches from Lewis to Donegal, but they can't come across with no games like that in the city of Montreal.
In this song, the atrocities of Ireland's colonized past are transferred to Canada. But Canada, of course, has its own colonization story. A story also found in the songs passed down through the Irish settlers.
No, I'll just start up the next song then. And
one of them I came across with Mike and Nancy Towns, a song recorded by Edith Folk.
It's a Canadian song, but
it's one of those songs that it's a complicated song now because it's from a settler's perspective that's singing about the natives and missionary work with the natives. And so it's one of those songs that Grandma knew and Grandpa Clary knew, but is out of context now, you know.
Neither Mike nor Nancy remember hearing the song when they were growing up, perhaps for good reason. The song is sung as if in the voice of a First Nations person speaking about the white man's arrival.
Yeah, it says that they didn't know Jesus, but anyway, you understand. I better go back, so it'll speed it up.
The song extols the virtues of colonization for the First Nations people, which makes for awkward listening today.
I could not read, I could not sew. My Savior's name I did not know. And as to parents disobeyed or to the Lord I never prayed.
It's a reminder of the broader colonization project in Canada, of which the Irish settlers were colonial settlers, something that can be difficult to talk about.
I thought of Grandpa Clary, great-grandpa Clary, working in the logging camps and knowing that he brought a lot of the songs that he taught my grandma from there. It made sense to me in that way that it might be a song that he would know. You know, how long it had been since he had sang it from that point, who knows? I think Edith wanted them to sing as many songs as they had in their head for her archives.
And as to parents disobeyed or to the Lord I never prayed.
When you wrote to me about using a part of the song, I wanted to like listen to how you wanted to use it, because I see the value in sharing it, honoring the best of everything and all we have to be thankful for, but not burying the ugly parts.
Now I can read, now I can sew, my Savior's name I've got to know. My Savior's name I will adore and bless the white man forevermore.
It's good that we know that that narrative existed, because it's not good when we forget.
Nancy helped plan this year's commemoration in Douro. For her, the consequences that came with the 1825 settlers was something that also needed to be remembered.
Here we are in 2025, commemorating the emigration that happened 200 years ago. For me, a big part of doing that well, and something that I've lost a lot of sleep from, is how are we going to do this with respect? With respect for the hardships of what our families, our ancestors had to go through, the heartbreak of what they had to leave behind, and not ignore the negative sides of this immigration, and because of colonialism, because of the complete alteration of life and the atrocities that came afterwards for First Nations and the Indigenous. So how do you honor both of those sides of the coin, both of those sides of the story?
When first that these white men, they came to our land.
This is another song recorded by Edith Folk and sung as if from an Indigenous perspective. But it has a very different message.
Little thinking those white men would e'er turn our foes.
Edith Folk notes that this song would have been sung by both European and Indigenous lumbermen in the camps.
But soon they began to impose on our rights.
It reflects a far more complex settler story.
They drove us away from our own native shore, where the smoke of our campfire rises no more. They built their large cities all over the land, and on the rich prairie their farmhouses stand. They own all the country.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I'm doing a bit of a radio piece about the commemorations.
One of the last stops I make before heading back to Ireland is to a building site in the center of Douro, where local man Tim Sheehan is working on a new monument for the 200th year anniversary.
And do you have a connection to the Peter Robinson?
Yeah, both sides of my family were part of the immigration. So I'm Sullivan, Sheehan, Fitzgerald, and Sweeney, sorry.
The monument is in the shape of a traditional Irish cottage gable wall, made from stones donated from descendants in Douro.
A lot of people dropped stones off that wanted to have something in the monument. So, yeah, we've got a stone in here from the original PG Town store, and other ones from different farms or whatever. So, yeah.
Attached to the wall, there is also a plaque telling the story of the 1825 Irish settlers.
Okay, Tim, I'll leave you. Thanks very much.
Okay, nice meeting you.
And good luck.
It acknowledges that the land settled was traditionally that of the Mishisagi Anishinaabeg, the First Nations people in this area. It then goes on to say that the Irish settlers of Douro had endured famine and pressure to give up their native culture in Ireland. So too would the Anishinaabeg following the settlement of this region. It is a very public acceptance of the complexity of this story. Building a new monument and memory for future generations.
Anybody grab a stick, anybody who feels like it, just to feel an old walking stick.
Sure.
We'll be around.
and you'll see me with the Canadian logo, and you can ask me any questions you like.
It's September 2025. I'm at Griston Bog near Mitchellstown for the grand finale of a homecoming commemoration in Ireland, honoring the Peter Robinson settlers and their migration to Canada.
So off you go, please, with Amanda.
Right. Thank you. All right, John.
Thank you, John.
Grab a stick if you want to stick. Keep me steady.
Descendants and locals are wandering through the forest and bogland of the 9-acre nature reserve. Here, Amanda Slattery is opening the first memorial site in Ireland devoted to the migration.
Mind your step. No trips. Don't fall into the bog water.
It's the end of a week of events, during which time Amanda has been shepherding descendants around the area.
Try not to fall into the bog. Stay on the path, single file. No bog swimming.
With musicians playing and people mingling, there's a feeling that everyone is family here.
You're looking very young looking.
Oh, I love you for so much. Mary, you're my new favorite person. Oh, I love you.
So I can only imagine how the Canadians are feeling this morning.
We're crying.
And crying? You're crying?
Like being ripped from our ancestors' arms.
Oh my God!
Again!
Like we were in tears. Like to think you're like, I don't know. It's just, I think it'll take a long time to process the reality. Thinking like that our ancestor did literally walked here.
Oh, this is beautiful in here.
I just love this space, do you know? And we actually put in a remembrance bench as well, so that it's just for anyone that's lost, that you just sit and you think.
For Amanda, it's a time to reflect on all that's been done.
There is probably no other immigration initiative where you had such a wraparound from place of origin, that sort of alliance of them leading in Canada, us leading in Ireland, and then working together to share that. But then you see it come to life, and sure, it's way beyond what you think it's going to be. Yeah.
Hey, John.
Thanks so much for all the work.
It's beautiful to hear it, isn't it?
Should we wander down there?
Yeah, they are.
John, how do you do?
Hi. I'm Doug.
How do you do?
Nice to meet you. You're very welcome. Yeah.
At the heart of the event, Amanda and her team have planted an oak tree, a commemoration tree, which is being dedicated today.
So we now say the prayer of blessing. Almighty God, we gather here in this ancient bog and in this season of creation. We thank you for creating...
This, to me, was their tree. I've said this to the communities. This has to be the best looked after tree in all of the county of Limerick and Cork.
This tree is part of your creation. As we plant it, we honour the memory of all our ancestors. Some have left a memory behind them, while the memory of others is lost in the mist of time. We ask you to pour out your blessing.
After the blessing, Amanda invites the descendants to help plant the tree.
Folks, gather in a little bit, just form a nice circle around here. And sit down if you'd like to sit down. Just gather around, folks. Come on in here. Would any of you like to come forward? We're just going to throw some soil onto the tree. Okay. Come on in. Just up. Let's grab a bit. Did you want to throw clay on the tree? You should, Margaret.
Anybody who wishes can have a photo up here putting soil on the tree. You're all welcome, please.
Nancy Towns has also come, traveling from Douro with her parents, Mike and Rosemary.
Can I throw on for Mum and Dad as well? Come here.
But also because her and Amanda have become close friends.
Irish sister.
are you okay? Do you come in for a group hug?
Thank you.
It's my job is to make you all cry this week. Isn't that what I've been doing? Go on, Mike, yeah.
The commemoration has created a memory no one here will forget.
Go on, Mike. That's the man. Finish the job.
There we go.
Keep going. Good girl. Good girl, Amanda.
They're sorry for my going away.
For me, the biggest thing of all is this is now back. It survived. It had, was in danger of just being another forgotten period in our history, and that would have been gone forever. That's where it was, like, and people did not know about this. But now they do. By God, they do. There's no denying it now.
Oh, fit me the parting glass. Good night and joy be with you all.
The voices of Cultas Ceoltóirí, Éireann Ballyharra, singing The Parting Glass, ending that programme, The Forgotten Migration. It was presented and produced by Chris Nicol. Thanks to Amanda Slattery and the Ballyharra Development Company, Patrick Leahy, Nancy Towns and the Douro 200th Anniversary Committee and everyone at Nine Ships 1825 Incorporated, which has a dedicated online presence to the Peter Robinson migration. Mike, Nancy and Rosemary Towns shared recordings from the Towns Family Archive and the additional singing by Nancy Towns and Gillian Coons. Additional Edith Folk recordings were provided by Smithsonian Folkways Recordings and from the Canadian Museum of History Archives. The Forgotten Migration is a Chris Nicol production for RTE Lyric FM, made with funding from RTE's Independent Radio Productions Unit, that's from your television licence fee, and additional funding from the Royal Irish Academy's commemoration bursary.
You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
The series producer is Owen O'Kelly, and the production coordinator is Michael O'Kane.
The Lyric Feature is available to listen to or to podcast from various well-known podcast platforms and also from the RTE radio app and, of course, The Lyric Feature's own webpage, which you'll find on the RTE website. You can contact the programme with your comments or observations, features.lyricfm@rte.ie.